The Nance spouses, only Crystal seemed unaware that Buck was fucking around. The other wives cracked down preemptively, grilling their husbands on a nightly basis while dropping the names of notorious divorce lawyers. Because of the family discord, the news of Buck's disappearance in Key West was not received with the utmost consternation by Junior, Buddy, or Cleroy. Like Miracle, they assumed Buck had been seduced by a female fan and was probably holed up in some nasty double-wide waiting for his hangover to abate. In the meantime, his absence presented an opportunity for the other Nances to carve larger roles for themselves on the television show.
"What the hell? Let's just tape the next episode without him," Cleroy suggested to John David Ampergroat during a conference call.
"Let me think on that.
Tell the writers to stick all this shit into the script. That Buck went and disappeared? Talk about monster ratings."
It was either Junior or Buddy speaking. Amp couldn't tell them apart over the phone. The idea itself wasn't terrible. After a few weeks, Buck could return, after a staged rehab, blaming booze and pills for his coarse behavior at the Parched Pirate, and apologizing tearfully to all the minorities he'd defamed.
Amp said, "That's an interesting concept, boys. I'll run it by Damien."
Next on the agenda was Miracle's insidious online stunt using the Bin Laden photo. The brothers agreed that a full-time keeper should be hired to supervise the loony bitch until Buck resurfaced. Amp said he'd already sent out a blast tweet saying the Brethren website had been sabotaged by Chinese intelligence agents who feared the growing global influence of the Nances now that Netflix was streaming the show.
"By the way," said Amp, "can any of you guys get me Buck's toothbrush? I'd ask Crystal, except her head's not in a great place right now."
Cleroy said, "Damien told us not to brush again till we go on hiatus."
"But flossing's okay," either Junior or Buddy cut in, "right?"
"A comb of Buck's would work just as well," John David Ampergroat said. "Toenail clippings, snotty handkerchief, hey, a cigar butt would be spectacular."
"What the fuck, Amp?"
"They've asked for a DNA sample."
"Who?"
demanded Cleroy.
"The sheriff down in the Keys. Standard procedure, guys. They want some of Buck's DNA, just in case, God forbid."
For several moments, no faux Cajun voices came from the phone speaker on Amp's desk, and he wondered if he'd upset the three brothers. Then, either Buddy or Junior piped up,
"I got something of Buck's, but they need to send somebody with a bag. I ain't touching the damn thing."
Mary Mansfield and Zito weren't interested in Martin Trabeau's grandiose plan to barge beach sand from Cuba across the Gulf Stream to Florida. Mary scoffed when he offered them a piece of the action in exchange for his freedom. Zito's response was an elbow to the larynx, which caused Martin Trabeau to black out, choking. He awoke, gagged and bound, on the bare floor of a bare house, where he overheard someone's future being discussed. It was his future, and the outlook was poor. The house was almost dark when Dominic Big Noogie Ayola arrived with a shorter man who stood at his side, mouthing an ivory toothpick. Big Noogie paid Zito with cash, and Zito paid Mary, who counted the bills by the light of her iPhone.
"What about the other guy you grabbed, the first guy?" Big Noogie asked.
Zito looked tightly at Mary.
"The mistake,"
Big Noogie elaborated.
"Oh, him, he's gone," Mary said.
"So that's all took care of?"
"Like it never happened."
"Good,"
said Big Noogie.
"You two can go now."
They did. The moment the duct tape was removed from Trabeau's trumpish lips, he blurted the story about the red-headed crash driver and her sexy shaving ploy.
"It's fucking brilliant,"
the swindler gushed to Big Noogie.
"Was that your idea?"
Big Noogie said,
No, this is my idea.
He took out a pair of 10-inch surgical hemostats, which he clamped onto the crotch of Martin Trabeau's linen pants.
Not my nutsack, wailed the Sandman.
What'd you expect? Said Big Noogie.
The Tesla was still in the alley beside the house, but Mary didn't hear any of Trabeau's screams because Zito was blasting Pitbull on the radio. When she asked Zito for a lift back to Miami, he said the car didn't have enough juice for the trip. The charging station in Key West was still under construction, so he drove down Simonton until he found a house with hurricane shutters on the windows. After backing into the driveway, he hopped out and plugged the Tesla's cord into a socket on the outside wall.
How long will this take? Mary asked.
I'm going to get a room at the La Concha, 2 beds.
No, thank you.
Then you're on your own, babe.
Mary was too tired to deal with Zito sneaking his hairy ass between the sheets in the middle of the night. She had a strict rule against cuddling with potential co-defendants.
What do you think's going to happen to Martin?
Ever see The Godfather? Zito asked.
Nope.
You're shitting me. Not even part one? Okay, then, Tony Soprano.
Who? Said Mary.
Do you live in a cave on Mars or what?
Don't be a dick. I know about the Mafia. All I ask you is what are they going to do to Martin, since you're the expert on everything?
Go rent the movie, Zito said and walked away.
While Mary waited to cross the street, 3 tow trucks rumbled past, one after the other. The first 2 were hauling the same type of cars, late model, silverish Buicks with rear-end damage. The 3rd truck was hauling a Honda Civic with a mangled front fender. Mary smiled at her handiwork. She walked back to the bed and breakfast on Catherine Street, where she'd booked a room. The place was packed with milky-limbed Austrians, who innocently plodded around town in black nylon socks and sandals. Mary found it endearing for the 21st century. She had the same reaction to Mennonites, who made no wardrobe concessions despite Florida's heartless humidity. The next morning, she checked out and headed toward Truman Avenue with a thought of hitching a ride, thereby avoiding 4 hours in a car with Zito. Yielding to a procession of Duval-bound tourists, she spotted a familiar face.
"Yo, Bob!"
she called out. Lane Kuhlman leaped sideways, landing with both shoes in the road. Mary yanked him clear of an oncoming moped and told him to chill for God's sake.
"Have you been following me?" he asked shakily. "Don't flatter yourself. It's a small island."
"I'm going straight to the police."
She said,
"Cool, I'll come with you. Let's see whose story they believe. You want to hear mine? All the perverted stuff you made me do after you tricked me into getting in your car? The ropes? The hot glue? The rollerblades?
Know what? You're a terrible human being. I mean a total sociopath.
And you'd be dead if it wasn't for me, don't forget. What are you still doing here is the question.
Where's your thug boyfriend?" Kuhlman glanced in both directions, then over his shoulder.
"I took care of all that," said Mary. "The mob guys think you're at the bottom of the sea, and Zito doesn't give a shit either way. So let's go grab a bite."
"Are you kidding? Here you are, all showered and peppy. I approve this new look." Self-consciously, Kuhlman reappraised the orchid print shirt and cantaloupe-colored Bermuda shorts that he'd paid for with the money that Amp had wired him.
"Just leave me the fuck alone," he said to Mary Mansfield.
"Don't you want your phone back? I've still got it."
"Then give it here."
When Kuhlman reached for her handbag, she grabbed his arm and twisted it behind him, spinning him on the sidewalk. The tourists, unfazed, trudged past like zombies.
"Let's get a basket of conch fritters," said Mary. "I want to hear what you're up to. A day in the life of a big-time Hollywood talent manager, whatever."
She let go of his arm. Kuhlman tried to act like it was nothing, like they were just fooling around, but he was shaken by how tough and ballsy she was. Dropping his voice,
"Just let me have my phone, please. I've got to find Buck Nance." "Want some help?"
"No."
"Oh, yes, you do, Bob."
She took his hand, nudged him with her hip, and that was that. Chapter 6. An artist friend met Yancey for lunch at Clippy's, and, working from photographs, penciled a sketch of what a clean-shaven Buck Nance might look like. Clippy said the face on the napkin resembled Keith Urban 20 years down the road, while Neil, the mayor, said no, the chin was totally David Duchovny. Neither Clippy nor Neil admitted to watching Bayou Brethren, but Yancey's straight artist friend said it was his second favorite reality show after Mud Wrestling Supermodels Cancun. Buck's celebrity status didn't impress Neil and Clippy, who vowed to prosecute him for shearing his gnarly growth into their acclaimed quinoa if the DNA test proved positive. They also hinted at the possibility of a civil lawsuit citing mental anguish. Yancey stopped by the city police department, where a detective who'd once helped him catch an albino ATM robber told him that all the road officers were on the lookout for Buck Nance. Sheriff Sonny Summers had made a call to the chief. Yancey skimmed the latest incident reports to see if Buck had committed any more crimes against hygiene. Most of the night log was routine Key West turpitude, drunken fistfights, inept dope deals, a handful of auto burglaries, one half-hearted domestic assault, the husband was struck with a bag of frozen snapper chum, and seven unsolved cases of public urination. A spate of shopliftings caught Yancey's attention because of their exceptional pettiness. An $11 T-shirt filched from a store on Simonton, a pair of black board shorts taken from a dive shop off of Caroline Street, and a Panama-style hat snatched from a window mannequin at Fastbuck Freddy's. In each instance, the theft had been witnessed by other customers, who described the shoplifter as a white, middle-aged male with a choppy facial burr. If Buck Nance was the perpetrator, such smallish crimes indicated he was roaming the streets dead broke. A second thumbing of the police reports turned up a break-in at a motel room, where the only articles stolen were a pair of size 12 flip-flops, a score that would pretty much complete Captain Cox's island wardrobe. Yancey spent the rest of the afternoon walking around Old Town. He spied several crisp Panama hats, though none of the noggins belonged to Buck Nance. At an upscale guest house, Yancey interviewed one of the shoplifting witnesses, a soft-spoken widow from Philadelphia. She addressed him as Detective, making him pine for the days when he carried a real badge. The widow said the napkin sketch sort of resembled the person she'd seen swiping the surf shorts, except there were dark bags under the thief's eyes.
"He looked more homeless," she said.
It mystified Yancey why Buck hadn't already fled the Keys. Possibly he'd lost a screw and turned paranoid after the uprising at the Parched Pirate. Nor could a drunken jag be ruled out, though it wouldn't explain the shoplifting spree. Another possibility was that Buck's disappearance had been a manufactured drama, a fake breakdown meant to mitigate his controversial performance at the bar. TV psychiatrists would be happy to theorize that poor Buck had cracked under the pressure of starring in a hit show, that his self-destructive outburst was the proverbial cry for help. Later, he would be found in calculated dishevelment, a squinting, haggard figure hustled away by family members in a cortege of anthracite SUVs. A hushed period of rehab would be followed by weepy public contrition, always a ratings booster. It was all speculation, because at this point Yancey knew nothing about the man's motives or his state of mind. Over beers at Pepe's, Rogelio Burton informed him that Buck's real name was Matthew Romberg.
Fantastic, Yancey exclaimed. I love it. He and the Brethren are from Wisconsin, of all places. They had an accordion band, I swear to God. Nobody's supposed to know. There were some videos on the internet, but they all got yanked once the boys signed their TV contract.
But I watched the show. They all talk Cajun, sort of.
Big deal. You should hear my Ringo Starr, and I've never set foot in Liverpool.
Yancey told Burton about the string of lame shopliftings and the witness's description of the suspect.
That could be half the bums on the island, the detective remarked.
The waitress brought an order of fried plantains. While eating, Burton delivered a mild lecture about Yancey firing a 12-gauge shotgun in front of civilians.
Hey, it's perfectly legal, Yancey asserted. Guy down the street from me has a pistol range in his backyard. All I did was murder a few beer bottles.
Sonny found out. He's not thrilled.
Who the hell told him?
Yancey feared that the Stella massacre would be added to the pile of perceived fuck-ups that the sheriff unsheathed whenever Yancey came pleading for reinstatement.
Burton said, "One of the dudes you scared shitless is a lawyer from Miami named Brock Richardson. He's got ads all over TV, which doesn't mean anything except that Sonny's heard of him.
He bought the lot next door, wants to build a McMansion for his girlfriend, who, by the way, offered me a BJ." Burton nodded.
"I get that all the time."
"No, she really did. You'll be proud to know I declined."
"Why?"
"Because I want to stay faithful to Rosa," said Yancey.
"No, asshole, I meant why did this total stranger offer you sex?"
"Who knows? Maybe it's just her way of being neighborly."
"A carrot cake is neighborly," Burton said. "A blowjob is a plan."
Yancey didn't tell his friend that Deb wanted him to help her find her lost diamond, which happened to be hidden inside his refrigerator. He knew that, like Rosa, Burton would advise him to return the ring as soon as possible.
"Tell me about this ace attorney," Yancey said. "He's way too important to dial 911, so he calls up Sonny's office direct, screaming that some crazy bastard's shooting up Big Pine Key."
"How did this jackoff pass the bar if he doesn't know the firearm statutes?"
"As usual, you're missing the point."
"Well, guess what? This is Florida, the land of batshit trigger-happy motherfuckers. Love it or leave it is what I say."
"Dial it down, Andrew, if you want your badge back. That's the takeaway."
Burton ate the last plantain, pushed the plate to the side, and ordered a cup of coffee. Yancey said, "Does he really want to live next door to a whack job like me? That's what this guy ought to be asking himself."
"Or he could just go to a gun show and buy a bigger cannon than yours. It is Florida, like you say."
Burton smiled. He was a good cop and a solid guy, still married to his college sweetheart. They had 3 kids, all soccer players, and drove them all over the state for tournaments. Rogelio didn't screw around on his wife, never stayed out late with the hard chargers. His was a life conducted with clear boundaries and deep commitments. Yancey envied his steadiness. If Burton had been mad at Yancey for getting booted from the detective bureau, he'd kept it to himself. Throughout their friendship, he'd always been the grown-up.
"Raj, I think Rosa's leaving me."
Burton sat back and slapped his hands on the tabletop.
"What the fuck did you do now?"
"I've got no idea, but she quit her job and she's off to Europe for a couple of weeks. We've all seen that movie. Weeks turn into months, and months turn into forever."
"For Christ's sake, Andrew, you always assume the worst."
"That's my motto. Put it on my tombstone. Assume the worst."
"What tombstone? You said you're getting cremated. You said you want your ashes scattered at high tide in Pearl Basin. See, I remember all this shit. The rum talking. Fine, then write it on my urn. Assume the fucking worst.
Yancey paid the tab and followed his friend out the door. Burton was meeting a source, a call girl who lived on Olivia down by the cemetery. He asked Yancey to tag along. Smart cops never went alone to interview prostitutes, because that's how rumors and occasionally true drama got started.
"Sonny's all over me to shake some trees, so I'd appreciate a little support," Burton said. "Other words, let me do the talking, okay?"
"So you think Buck Nance got waylaid by a hooker?"
"Probably not Giselle, but it's possible she's heard something."
"Giselle, is it? My goodness, Raj.
Try to control yourself."
Giselle had a neat wooden house with canary yellow shutters and a spice garden in the front yard. She was getting ready for a date, hurrying between the bathroom and bedroom, wearing dark hose, black panties, and a matching bra. It looked like her closet had detonated, clothes flung all over the place. Burton and Yancey weren't sure where to sit down, so they didn't. Out of habit, Yancey scanned the baseboards for rodent scat, but he saw nothing. After Giselle finally picked out a dress to wear, she was shown the napkin sketch of Buck Nance, along with a photograph of him fully bearded. She stated without pause that she'd never laid eyes on the man. Burton explained that Buck and his brothers had a popular cable television show.
"Any of your girlfriends say anything about hooking up with a famous John?"
Giselle smiled as she put on her lipstick in front of the hallway mirror.
"That's what we're all waiting for, right? The Brad Pitt call."
"So the answer's no?"
"I'll ask around," she said. "Are we done? Because I gotta run."
Burton laid a $50 bill on the kitchen counter, which, Yancey noted, was cleaner than some of the restaurants on his beat, and signaled that they should leave.
"Hang on," Yancey said.
Next to the bagel toaster was an empty silver money clip. He picked it up and showed Burton the ornate engraving. Captain Cock.
"Isn't that the nickname of our missing shit kicker?" he said.
Giselle turned from the mirror.
"No offense, Tiger, but who the hell are you? Raj, is this nosy prick your new partner?"
"He works for the state. Officially, it's Inspector Yancey, but everyone calls him Andrew."
"Inspecting what? Thongs?"
It wasn't Yancey's fault. The furniture was strewn with lingerie that Giselle had tried on and rejected.
"The dude who gave me that silver clip isn't the one you're looking for," she said. "I took it because he only had $73 in his pocket, and my price is $150. He tried to give me a hard time, but I said, 'Listen, Captain Cockhead, you play, you pay.' I told him he's got 3 business days to bring me the rest of the cash he owes. Otherwise, I'm totally pawning that thing."
Burton said, "You're positive that it's not the person in the sketch or photograph?"
Giselle cackled.
"Not unless he fell asleep on a tanning bed for about 6 months."
"Your gentleman acquaintance was of dark complexion?"
"Very much so. He said he found the money clip just laying in the dirt under one of those big trees on Whitehead, which I'm so sure."
"Ever seen him before?" Yancey asked.
"He busts tables at the Bull. Name's Winchell."
Yancey slipped the silver clip into his pocket. "Police evidence," he said to Giselle. "Sorry."
"Yo, wait! How do you even know it's the same Captain Cock?"
She glared indignantly at Burton, who laid down another 50.
"If Winchell comes back," he said, "tell him I need to speak with him right away. Give him my cell number."
"All right, he'll be so chatty."
Giselle stooped to put on a pair of nosebleed heels. She glanced up at Yancey and said,
"Quit staring at my tits, Inspector."
"I'm not staring." And he wasn't either. He was practically 100% certain.
"Make him stop,"
Giselle said to Burton, who laughed.
"Don't you be flirting with my boy. He's got enough problems."
Back in the car, Burton told Yancey to give him the money clip. Don't worry, Raj. I'm not going to lose it. Hand it over. I need something to show the sheriff.
So he'll think you're hot on the trail, right?
Just give me the damn thing, Burton said.
Yancey reached over and attached the silver piece to the driver's side visor so that the inscription was visible.
What if Winsome Giselle is right?
Burton, who was wrestling a bulky seatbelt, said,
You mean if there's more than one Captain Cock?
It's Key West, Raj. There might be a franchise.
I'm going to drop by Sonny's office and fill him in on what we've got. What I've got.
Good old Sonny, Yancey said. It'll be nice to see him.
You're not coming.
What could it hurt? Just a quick hello.
Burton cut the wheel hard and pulled away from the curb in a manner that ended the conversation.
Ben, drop me on Duval, said Yancey. Now that Rosa's bid farewell, Buck Nance is my new obsession.
Why don't you go home and lie around feeling sorry for yourself until she comes back? Tell Lombardo you can't work because you caught hantavirus from breathing all those rat hairs. Drink heavily, smoke too much dope, sleep late, and don't bathe. I'll swing by to check your pulse every few days.
The human bloodhound is what they call me.
A pain in the sphincter is what they call you. Please don't screw up my case.
Yancey stepped out of the car at the corner.
You'll be the first to know when I track down this character, he said to Burton. Keep your ringer on, amigo.
Winchell wasn't working at the Bull that night, but the barmaid gave Yancey an address in Bahama Village. It was Winchell's wife who answered the door. In a clamorous scrum behind her, Yancey counted four small kids. Winchell emerged from a back room wearing a towel and a frown. He looked much older than his wife and stood at least 6'2", though his arms were thin and his gut was flabby.
Who are you, man? Get out of my house!
Police business, said Yancey, which was true enough. It was police business to which he was contributing his expertise, solicited or not.
Put on some clothes and let's take a walk.
Winchell did what he was told and never asked to see a badge, so convincing was Yancey's cop-like comportment. Nor did Mrs. Winchell raise a challenge as her husband was led out the door, instead scalding him with a glare that made clear she presumed him guilty of any and all accusations. Yancey waited until they were a block from the house before asking Winchell about the money clip he gave to Giselle.
I didn't give her nothing. She took it.
Where'd you get it from?
That bitch say I stole it? She be a damn liar.
Winchell wanted Yancey to understand how insulted he felt.
She didn't say you stole it, Winchell.
Well, she still be a damn bitch for taking it away from me.
Is your wife aware you slept with a prostitute?
Winchell looked away, muttering.
Yancey said, Forget Giselle, tell me about the silver clip.
Nothing to tell. I found it.
Where? Show me.
They turned and walked north along Whitehead. Winchell stopped beneath an immense banyan tree as old as the pirate town. The tree's peripatetic roots had tunneled a hump in the sidewalk and disfigured a nearby brick wall. Winchell pointed to a spot on the ground and said,
Right here.
You just happened to look down and there it was? Lucky you.
I was just chilling in the shade, man, having a smoke.
For some reason, Yancey believed him. On the tree were fresh bark scrapes that could have been made by the toe of a heavy shoe. It was possible that Buck scrambled up the banyan to hide, causing the money clip to fall out of his pocket. It was also possible that Winchell had mugged him, although a 45-year-old busboy was not your prototypical Key West street predator. Yancey asked Winchell how much cash he'd found in the clip. Again, he puffed up, indignant.
Man, there was no cash. What are you saying?
I don't give a damn whether you kept it or not. I just want to know how much was there.
Do I gotta give it back? 'Cause we've been having some expenses.
You don't have to give back any of it.
All right, then. I counted 600 even,
Winchell said. Yancey felt confident doubling the sum in his head. Any credit cards, ATMs?
No.
I knew you were too smart for that rookie shit, Yancey said. Stolen plastic leaves a trail. Plus, every time you swipe it through a machine, there's a camera snapping your picture. Winchell managed a nod, though his face was clouding with unease. Did you see anybody else around? Yancey asked. Someone sleeping on the sidewalk or maybe passed out in the bushes? He took out the artist's drawing of the shaved Buck Nance and a photo of the bearded version. Winchell said neither face looked familiar. Yancey thanked him and told him he could go.
I appreciate that, said Winchell. But listen here, my wife, she don't know about the cash money I found and so forth.
What did you spend it on?
There's a poker game over on Seminary.
Let me guess how that worked out, Yancey said.
Man, you can't never win if you don't take a chance. Even a good book says so.
I'm pretty sure it doesn't. The breeze brought a jumble of music and cheers from Mallory Square, where the crowd was assembling for sunset. Winchell was in no rush to go home. He said,
Yo, the man lost that money clip. He must be hung like a horse. They be calling him Captain Cock.
He got that name because he's in the rooster business. Winchell seemed let down.
We got too many goddamn roosters, you ask me.
Key West was overrun with chickens, an issue that had long divided the community. The birds were loud and messy, yet some locals thought they were cute. Winchell did not agree, nor did Yancey, who'd been dispatched to more than one outdoor cafe after patrons complained about the bold, loose-boweled fowl. When Yancey asked him about Bayou Brethren, Winchell said he'd never watched the show and complained that his wife maintained a Baptist's iron fist on the TV remote.
Listen, she'll kill me if she finds out I was with another woman. I mean, she'll kill me, cut off my fucking jewels, and then kill me all over again. Understand what I'm saying?
Then you'd better pay Giselle what you owe. Otherwise, she'll be knocking at your front door. Winchell said,
I'll pay up soon as I can. She knows I'm good for it.
Go tell your wife we're cool. I'm not taking you to jail tonight.
I appreciate that. I do.
Yancey put a hand on his shoulder. Now, here's what happens next. I'm going to stroll very casually up the street, pretend I thought of one more question to ask, turn around and hurry back. But you'll already be gone.
Yes, sir.
Then I'm going to stop at this very same spot under this very same tree, where I will unexpectedly see something important lying on the ground, something I missed the first time.
You just might, Winchell said quietly.
I thought so. Chapter 7. Bottom line, it wasn't even your idea, Lane Coolman said. It was my idea to do it on purpose, absolutely. Mary Mansfield was explaining the inspiration for the razor scam. I was up in Miami doing these boring insurance crashes when I read about a chick who rammed a car full of tourists while she was shaving her bikini area. That's what the newspaper called it, her bikini area. She told the cops she was tidying up down there to meet a boyfriend and took her eyes off the road, which was too good not to be true. The accident was totally legit, but the visual is what got me thinking. The concept of staging it that way. I knew I could turn it into something that would pay way better than those scumbag claim runners. So a friend put me in touch with Zito, who was doing routine bump and grabs for dopers and loan sharks. First, he thought I was full of shit, but then I rented a Caprice and set up a random crash to prove my plan would work.
my presentation, let's say. I did the bump right on Biscayne and 36th at rush hour. Some school teacher in a Saab, older than my mom. He was so mad when he got out of his car, but then he saw me sitting there with a razor in my hand and my pink undies all bunched up, and swear to God, he almost asked me to marry him. He ends up giving me 500 cash to get my rental fixed, and the wreck was all my fault. I totally plowed into the dude at a stoplight, okay? Men are so pitiful.
Kuhlman said, "You need to lay off the energy drinks."
I know, right? Ever since I quit smoking, they say coffee's healthier, but I hate the taste.
Why not just wear a super short skirt for the crash? The snatch shaving thing, that's pretty twisted.
These days you need more than a great pair of legs, Bob. You need to boggle their little minds. A performance artist is what I am, basically, not just a stunt driver.
I've never heard of anyone running a game like this, not even in L.A. Mary said,
I could definitely rock it there, no doubt.
And everything else you told me about yourself?
All lies, pretty much, yeah.
They were sitting at an umbrella table poolside at the Casa Marina, where Platinum Artists Management had booked a top-floor room for Kuhlman.
Can I have my phone now? He asked.
Mary took it from her purse.
Battery's dead as a doornail.
The charger was in his travel bag, which was still in the crumpled trunk of the Buick, locked in an impound lot somewhere on the island.
Use mine, Mary offered.
It was the same model iPhone as his. He got on YouTube and looked at the video clips from the parched pirate. Mary scooted her chair closer to watch.
So that's your man? The talent you manage?
He had a bad night, Kuhlman said tightly. What he saw and heard made him heartsick. Mary cackled.
Bad night? The dude's a total homophobe. Also a bigot.
There's a culture gap, that's all.
No, it's a decency gap, Bob. Your client's a flaming a-hole. What's the matter with you? I'm so disappointed.
Kuhlman had received other morality lectures, though never from a professional criminal. Even more depressing than the bar videos were the comments flooding the Bayou Brethren's Facebook fan page. The condemnations of Buck's tasteless performance were to be expected, but the ranting responses of his defenders, including an unnervingly literate covey of white supremacists, were so loathsome that Kuhlman was taken aback. He hoped Amp was working to have the offending posts deleted.
I need to call California, in private, if you don't mind. Ah, what's her name?
No, it's strictly business, Kuhlman said.
You're such a dog, Bob. Want a drink?
She didn't wait for his answer and headed for the pool bar. Lane Kuhlman was a dog. His gaze locked on Mary's butt as he dialed Amp's number. Would it be wrong to seduce your own kidnapper? Kuhlman wondered. Not after all the grief she'd caused him. She was probably a sociopath, but so were half the women he screwed in Hollywood. He wished she'd use his real name and stop calling him Bob. When Amp finally got on the line, they commiserated about the internet mudfest, which Amp characterized as a primitive character assassination of Buck Nance. Has anybody heard from him yet? Kuhlman asked.
You mean like kinfolk? No, sir. Not Crystal or the brothers.
What about the kids?
Negative.
Buck and Crystal had two grown sons, both private equity managers, who declined to participate in Bayou Brethren and therefore went unmentioned on the show.
You're his go-to guy, Amp said. Manager, confidant, pimp, shepherd, you're the one we assumed he'd be calling.
What about Miracle? He usually talks to her every day. He's terrified not to.
Don't mention that psychotic witch, Amp told him about the twisted Bin Laden photo prank. She's convinced Buck ran off with a groupie. He's the only one that can calm her crazy ass down.
Amp, I don't even know where to start looking.
The whole damn island of Key West is only 4 square miles.
Then send SEAL Team 6, Kuhlman wanted to say. He was still smarting from his boss's phlegmatic reaction to the 6-figure ransom demand from Zito and Mary. What other agent had come so close to sacrificing his life for platinum artists? Amp didn't seem to care.
What are the cops saying? Kuhlman asked.
We're wiring some dough to the sheriff's re-election, so he's keeping me in the loop. They've got a few decent leads.
Like what?
Buck hacked off his beard, Amp reported. A food inspector's got the remains, or whatever you call it. The DNA test came back positive.
A food inspector? Jesus Christ.
I know. If the cops find Buck before you do, they've promised to hold him in a safe place. By then, the jet'll be on the way.
Kuhlman was trying to picture his famous client clean-shaven.
How's the family dynamic? He asked Amp.
I've been on the horn with the network all morning. They like Cleroy's idea of doing a show about Buck's vanishing act. The whole clan gathered anxiously at the rooster farm, waiting for news.
Rolling up on their Harleys, right?
Absolutely, Amp said. Product placement never sleeps.
In their transformation from Rombergs to Cajuns, the brothers had been schooled in certain rural skills, as prioritized by the program's Manhattan-born set designer. At the top of the list was dipping tobacco, shooting firearms, and mastering motorcycles. Buck had destroyed his first Harley within an hour of delivery, fracturing both ankles when he slid into the rear axle of a sod truck. While confined to a wheelchair, he employed a shotgun to herd the roosters, a gruesome panorama that caused the Beretta Corporation to withdraw its sponsorship of the show. Buck was mended completely from his accident, but a stunt double now performed most of his motorcycle scenes, and Buck's 20-gauge was loaded only with rock salt.
"We're taping a new episode tomorrow," Amp said.
"You're joking."
Kuhlman sensed his influence was eroding in Buck's absence. The other brothers previously had been lobbing for more FaceTime on camera, Cleroy in particular, who was spurred by his wife, a shrill blonde fireplug with a fondness for Bergdorf's.
"No time to waste," said Amp. "We expect Kardashian Nielsen's."
The tabloid shows and websites were hot on the story. In the hotel lobby, Kuhlman and Mary had passed a crew from E.T. interviewing some sunburned goober who claimed to have seen Buck lighting out for the Marquesas on a lemon-yellow jet ski.
"On the show, each of the other brothers will be given a theory to push," Amp explained. "Did Buck have a mental breakdown? Was it foul play? Maybe he fell on his head while running from the bar, and now he's got amnesia. It's all good stuff. Crystal doesn't cry easy, but we've got somebody working with her."
"And what if Buck shows up tomorrow?"
"Then he makes a grand entrance."
A laugh came from Amp's end of the call.
"We'll rewrite on the fly."
Mary had returned to Kuhlman's table with 2 frosty rum drinks. She'd also changed into a sleek one-piece swimsuit that undoubtedly had been charged to his room, which was fine with him.
"We're even doing a prayer vigil scene at the church,"
Amp went on, recapturing Kuhlman's attention. The church was a creation of the Brethren writers. They called it the first Chickapaw Tabernacle of Hope and Holiness. Buck had demanded the title of deacon, while the other 3 brothers settled for being elders. A chapel-like structure was erected on the site of an old sawmill 4 miles south of the Cock Farm. Several fevered worship scenes had been taped there, Buck sermonizing on the traditional Christian values of country life. The small congregation was comprised of community theater actors and drama students bussed from FSU. All were paid in cash and required to sign confidentiality agreements.
"You know Buck better than anyone outside the immediate gene pool," Amp was saying to Kuhlman. "This is not a complicated organism we're dealing with. Put yourself inside this fuck whistle's head. If you were him, where would you go to hide out?"
"Not this town," Kuhlman said to himself.
Back in the hotel room, he plugged his dead phone into Mary Mansfield's charger while she took a bath with the door locked. When the phone's touchscreen finally flashed to life, he found no texts or voice messages from the missing Nance patriarch. It was beyond peculiar. Buck normally called when he was drunk, when he was high, when he was bored, when he was scared, when he was with a woman, when he didn't know what he was with or where he was. For almost 2 years, Buck had reached out to his manager multiple times a day, at any hour, and for the flimsiest of reasons. Now, nothing. Kuhlman briefly considered, then chased from his thoughts, the crushing possibility that his most important client, his friend and meal ticket, the prime reason for his meteoric ascent at Platinum Artists, had dumped him for another agent. A second scenario, not quite as unbearable as the first, Buck Nance was dead. The third and most likely storyline, he was lying low in a state of fear, exhaustion, or petulance. Mary emerged, wringing her hair with a towel.
"Cheer up, Bob," she said. "I bet I can find that idiot."
The next day, Yancey called Burton to say he'd recovered Buck Nance's credit cards, a gold Amex and a black Visa.
"Excellent. Where?"
"Under the same tree Winchell found the money clip."
"Go figure."
"Call it a pang of conscience," Yancey said. "He's already spent the cash."
"This is good, though, finding the plastic. I'll let Sonny know. Be sure to tell him how I worked the old magic on my witness."
"Small steps, Andrew."
"Any news on your end?"
Burton disclosed that the hair in Clippy's quinoa definitely came from Buck Nance's beard.
"The DNA matched a big gob of tobacco he'd hawked into one of his brother's golf bags. Episode 18, in case you missed it, Road Trip to Augusta. Anyway, they overnighted the chaw to a lab in Miami, and bingo on the saliva."
"No surprise there," Yancey said.
"You know the wine shop where that model worked, the one who was in Sports Illustrated?"
"That snob. It was like 10 years ago she made the swimsuit issue. At least 10 years.
"Right, because she wouldn't have a drink with you, that makes her a snob. I remember. Anyway, the shop has security video of a guy entering a side courtyard who resembles our missing shit-kicker. He puts on a bum photo T-shirt and rips off the sleeves," Burton said. "Then, for reasons unknown, he punches out some artist dude's easel."
"Maybe the painting was really awful."
"No, man, the canvas was blank."
"On the plus side," said Yancey, "this means Buck's still alive, alert, and ambulatory." Burton said he went to speak with the artist, but it was a waste of time.
"He offered me $50 to sit for a nude portrait. You believe that shit?"
"Totally. You've got the body of a Greek god who lives on pasta."
"Bite me."
Yancey got distracted by something he saw through the back window. He hung up on Burton, hurried outside, jumped the fence, and jogged across the empty lot toward Deb, the frantic fiancée. She was waggling a long-handled metal detector, which, upon seeing Yancey, she raised at a defensive angle.
"Easy, neighbor," he said. "I came to apologize for grossing you out the other day."
"Stay the hell away from me."
"Honest, there's no corpse buried under my house. The hair in the baggies is evidence in a missing persons case."
Deb had the look of a spooked mare, confirming to Yancey that he was successfully establishing himself as an eccentric.
"Brock says you nearly shot him the other day," she said.
"What a crybaby. It was target practice with beer bottles, perfectly legal recreation."
"Not in a residential neighborhood."
"The sad song of a deluded liberal. Never once did I point that gun in Brent's direction. You have my word."
"It's Brock," Deb snapped. "He made some calls. He says you're not really a cop."
"In what sense? Because I could argue the point."
"Just stay back."
Today's ensemble was skinny jeans, a pale rose blouse, and matching tennis shoes. Her ash-blonde hair was cinched with a white scrunchie. The shades were Chanel, naturally, non-polarized and therefore useless against the tropic glare. Yancey took her metal detector and demonstrated a better search technique, vectoring between the red survey flags while sweeping the wedge-headed device back and forth above the ground. He thought of Rosa's sound admonition to return the lost diamond ring, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. Not just yet. Fuming, Deb followed him at what she perceived was a safe distance. She said, "I can't believe I almost blew you."
"I can't believe I said no. There might be sainthood in my future."
Yancey stooped to pick up a rusty flathead nail that the detector had revealed with a warble. He put the nail in his pants pocket, thinking of the key deer, which sometimes browsed the open lot at dusk. A punctured hoof pad could cause a nasty infection. He asked Deb if she'd finally informed her future husband that she'd lost the engagement ring on the site of their dream home. "Brock doesn't need to know," she said. "I'll find it myself."
"And if you don't? What happens when the backhoes show up to clear the property? They'll bury that rock forever."
She dragged sourly on her e-cig. The metal detector cheeped again. Yancey picked up a tarnished dime, minted in 1973.
"Back then, we were both in snuggies," he said. "I still wear one on special occasions."
"You are disgusting."
"At a minimum."
When he handed the coin to Deb, she slapped it out of his hand. He said,
"I were you, I'd stall Brad as long as possible."
"Brock, you dick! Brock, Brock, Brock!"
"Don't let him bring in the heavy machinery until you've searched every square inch of this property. I'll help you, Deb, but you've got to stay strong."
"How do I stall him? He wants the slab poured by next week."
"Not happening," thought Yancey.
"Isn't the ring insured?"
Her answer was a bitter no.
"If it was insured, he could get his money back and buy me a new one, which is what I deserve instead of wearing some other tramp's diamond."
"He hasn't noticed it's not on your finger?"
"I told him it's at the jeweler getting sized. That's what makes me so mad. This is actually his fuck-up, not mine. If he'd given me a ring that fit, my own ring, instead of hers, it wouldn't have fallen off."
Because Richardson had been too lazy, or too cheap, to insure the $200,000 pebble, the search for it was bound to continue, delaying construction and buying Yancey some time. He fully intended to surrender the diamond once Deb and her beau split up, scrapped their vulgar house plans, and put the lot up for sale. In Yancey's mind, he hadn't stolen the gem. He was holding it in protective custody. When the time came, he would return it in anonymous, untraceable packaging. The metal detector led Yancey to two more nails, a bent stub of rebar, and a size 7-bar-0 fishing hook. Deb warned that Brock was having him investigated by professionals, which Yancey saw as a positive development. The details of his personal history would only heighten Richardson's doubts about Yancey's fitness as a neighbor.
"Tell me something," he said to Deb. "Why do you lovebirds need to build such a huge place? What's wrong with a classic 4-3 ranch style? That's plenty roomy for a vacation home, and you'd have space in the yard for a pool."
Deb said, "Nobody in Florida with Brock's kind of money builds a one-story house. I can't believe you'd say that."
"What is Brock's kind of money?"
"Enough to fill a bounce house and roll around in naked. Haven't you seen the ads on TV? He's got all the Petrolux lawsuits, a gymungus class action."
Petrolux was a deodorant armpit gel that also boosted testosterone. The target market segment was middle-aged men with slack penises and gagging body odor, but the refreshing juniper scent had attracted teenage girls who failed to read the warning label while rifling their parents' medicine cabinets. Among the jarring side effects of Petrolux were volcanic acne, yam-sized larynxes, and goatees as lush as any in the NBA. Scores of young plaintiffs, including a squad of misfortunate high school cheerleaders from Austin, went after the drug manufacturer, the labs, the retailers, and even Ben Affleck, the famed actor who was the voice on the Petrolux commercials. Affleck had been quickly dropped from the lawsuit and held blameless by a judge who happened to be a diehard fan of Gigli. "Your fiancé must be quite the busy beaver at the courthouse," Yancey said. Deb laughed. "Brock doesn't do any trial work. He farms all the cases to other lawyers who specialize."
"So he's basically an 800 number, a referral switchboard. What's his split of the settlements, or does he take a flat fee?"
She nodded toward her Porsche. "However he collects it works just dandy for me."
"What a country," said Yancey.
"Grow up." She asked if she could leave the metal detector so that Yancey could keep searching in his spare time. He played along, waving as she roared off. After lunch, a sardine and tomato sandwich, he went online to locate Rosa on Flight Tracker. According to the miniature jet icon on the map, the plane hadn't yet departed from Miami. He sent a pining note in the hope she was checking her emails. Tommy Lombardo called, asking Yancey to rush to a new seafood joint in Marathon called the Reef Raff.
"Maybe tomorrow," said Yancey. "Today I've got a McDonald's, a Checkers, and Stoney's, of course, which'll take all afternoon."
The owner of Stoney's Crab Palace, a man named Brennan, was a serial offender of the health codes. Roaches were so plentiful at his restaurant that Yancey used an improvised suction device to expedite the roundups. Lombardo told him to forget Stoney's and proceed at full speed to the Reef Raff.
"Something's moving in their mango salsa," he reported gravely. "Yum."
When Yancey first went on roach patrol, he'd dropped 30 pounds in a haze of constant revulsion. These days, almost nothing bothered him. "Exactly what type of movement was observed?" he asked Lombardo.
"Wiggling is what they said."
"Wiggling or wriggling?"
"What the fuck's the difference? They got a lady fainted face first into the salad bar. Fire rescue's on the way. So is freaking Channel 7.
"Then I'll shut the place down right away." Yancey knew his boss dreaded emergency closures, which generated reams of paperwork in addition to unwanted publicity. Among restaurant inspectors, it was considered the nuclear option.
"Now hold on, Andrew. Don't do a damn thing till you find out what you're dealing with up there. Maybe it's not so bad."
"And what kind of life form would be acceptable in a platter of salsa, regulation-wise?"
"Work with the man," Lombardo implored. "That's all I'm saying."
Yancey got dressed in his inspector clothes, including a semi-clean necktie, and organized the contents of his briefcase. Halfway down Key Deer Boulevard, he decided he wasn't up for a maggot inquiry. It was simply too nice a day. A stern phone call to the Reef Raff ensured that the condiment in question would be sealed and preserved for Yancey's future scrutiny. Upon reaching the overseas highway, he aimed his car in the opposite direction of Marathon, back toward Key West. The supermodel who'd rejected Yancey was long gone from the wine shop, but the college-age woman behind the counter was happy to help. She left him alone in the broom closet office, where a desktop computer cycled black-and-white loops from the shop's security cameras. Although the courtyard video lasted only 30 seconds, the quality was crisp enough for Yancey to see that the unbearded man donning the bum-farto shirt closely resembled the sketch of Buck Nance. His assault on the artist's canvas seemed like the spontaneous act of a batty street person, but without any audio, it was impossible to know if Buck and the aspiring Renoir had exchanged harsh words beforehand.
Is Bum Fardo a real person? I see those T-shirts all over town.
The young clerk was watching the video clip over Yancey's shoulder. Like a heron, she'd stepped silently into the cubby.
Bum was the fire chief here a long time ago, Yancey said. He got busted for dealing blow from the station house, but he disappeared before they could put him in jail. The locals say he ran off to Costa Rica and lived like a king. By now he's dead from old age, but the legend lives on in casual wear.
The woman leaned in for a closer look.
So, what's the deal with a skanky dude?
That's Buck Nance. The other detectives didn't tell you. He's on Bayou Brethren.
Never heard of it.
Darling, you just made my day, Yancey said.
Why are you guys looking for him?
There's a fear he might endanger himself.
The shop clerk shrugged.
Isn't that why people come here?
Yancey walked out, thinking he was wasting his time. Sonny Summers probably wouldn't rehire him, even if he personally delivered Buck Nance. It was an election year, and Yancey's name was still toxic, or so the sheriff would claim. The search for Captain Cock offered therapeutic diversion from the Rosa setback, but a selfless act of public service it wasn't. If the cops didn't find the bogus Cajun chicken farmer, the tabloids would. On the drive to Marathon, Yancey unilaterally took himself off the case, vowing to save his meddling for serious true crimes. He was elbow deep in mango salsa when Burton called to tell him about the dead body.
Chapter 8.
The old Bahia Honda Bridge was chosen for its altitude, scenic vista, and lack of bystanders. It had been built for Henry Flagler's train and was later paved for automobile use. Dominic Big Noogie A.O.